Today's episode of Necronomicast is brought to you by the Omaha Film Festival 2013. In their eighth year, the Omaha Film Festival will be running March 6th through 10th at the Regal Stadium 16, right here in Omaha, Nebraska. Go to omahafilmfestival.org for showtimes and more information. Now, on with the show.
Good evening, Perry.
I own a motel. Not too far from you. And you'd be welcome to spend the night in one of the empty rooms if you'd like.
Oh, it burns! Oh, it burns! But I'm the devil!
Welcome, horror fans, to another episode of the Necronomicast. My name is Wayne, and today on the show, Doug Jones. Yes, I'm excited about this interview. I've been waiting and been really trying to get Doug Jones on the phone. I had lots of questions for him as a fan as well as host of the show. Now, if you don't know who Doug Jones is, I am sorry for you. Most people would know him from Pan's Labyrinth. He was, of course, the Fawn as well as the scary white creature with the eyes on his hands. Most people would also know him from Hellboy. Those are some of the ones that he's most known for, but check out his IMDb. Go back. You're going to find more than a few movies that you've probably seen him in and not even known. Because he's a great character actor, and he also does a lot of films outside of his makeup. And, as you'll see, there's a story behind all this. So let's get right to the story. And here's my interview with Doug Jones right here on the Necronomicast. Okay, Doug, well, thank you so much for joining me here on the Necronomicast.
Oh, it is my pleasure, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Now, are you calling from California? Are you you're West Coast?
I am. I'm in sunny California. It's really warm today, thank goodness, finally.
That's nice, yes.
You've got no sympathy back there, I know that.
Yeah, I know. I miss California, though. So first off, I kind of want to go back. I know that many people know who you are. I actually am going to have to tell you right up front, I'm doing this interview as the host of the show and also as a big fan.
Oh, that's very kind. Well, I'm a fan of yours too now.
Excellent. Well, you might get questions on both sides. But as far as when you were first starting, I know if even people that are fans of yours, if they know, you know, kind of how you got into the industry, what led up to that, I wanted to ask some questions about first leading up into getting into film. I know that you had been practicing mime. I'm assuming you weren't one of those chunky kids that all of a sudden hit a growth spurt.
No, you're assuming. I've always been a long, lanky kid ever since I came out of. I think my mom gave birth to a boa constrictor, and that became me. Is what I think happened.
So when you found out that this is how you your body was, and you were able to I don't know when you got into doing contortion or mime, what led you into film in the very first place when you first decided, hey, you know what, I think I could do something?
Well, I had dreams and aspirations of being an actor when I was a kid. Anyway, growing up in Indiana watching TV, but it was not the horror fantasy genre that was interested me. I mean, I liked the classic old tales of, like, you know, the Boris Karloff, Frankenstein and the Mummy, and the Creature from the Black Lagoon, and those movies, like, had an effect on me as a kid. But what I really wanted to do with my life was make people laugh and do song and dance and entertain people. I think it was big production musicals and sitcoms that really, really sunk into me. Like watching the old Dick Van Dyke Show or the Andy Griffith Show, and watching Barney Fife be a goofy sidekick, and Gomer Pyle, and all those old black and white shows or Gilligan's Island. I understood the goofy characters on all those shows, and the Carol Burnett Show. Anything variety driven or that had song and dance numbers in it as well. It was all feel good stuff. And when we went to the movie theaters or my parents would make time to watch a movie on TV, and this was back when we only had three networks, and and it was big. You know, then they ran a movie at night. It was a big sit down with the family and pop the corn and do the thing. It was always the musicals. It was Singing in the Rain or White Christmas or whatever. So Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, those guys had huge influence on me as well.
Oh, right.
So that's what I wanted to be. So when I got out to L.A. in March of 1985, it was more of a I realize I'm tall, skinny. I'm not a romantic leading male. I'm going to have to be either funny or scary. So let's try that. All right. And but with the mime background that you mentioned, I started doing mime in college. That physicality, coupled with the tall, skinny, goofy build, with a small bone structure, mm-hmm. even though I'm really almost six four. That's a combination that I had no idea the creature effects makeup industry loves, because they can build right. stuff on me and make me. They can make me a big imposing figure, or they can make me a tall, skinny alien figure. I can do all sizes and whatever. They can build things on me without getting too bulky. The whole thing. And so I started with TV commercials. I found an agent who loved my goofy ways. And with the mime and being able to contort and putting my legs behind my head, making me bendy and flexible, those items on my resume made me rather attractive in the TV commercial world for sight gags and for tomfoolery, right?
Right, exactly. All right.
So one of my very first gigs on TV was my fourth commercial booking. Was the Mac Tonight campaign for McDonald's, which was a crescent moon head sang at a piano, and it was a very popular commercial campaign with a song, "When the Clock Strikes." Hey,
right, yeah,
that's it. Hey, yeah. This cool cat that was a crescent moon with a face on it. It was all puppeteered by creature effects makeup people, and that really went gangbusters. And 27 commercials, and 3 years later, that campaign was still going strong.
Wow.
And by then, I was known as tall, skinny, goofy guy who moves well and wears stuff and doesn't complain in the makeup.
Yeah.
So that reputation then, is what got me referred again and again. So that's kind of how I got started. And so that would then, fold it over into movies, because a lot of the creature effects makeup people that were catching wind of this tall, skinny Doug Jones guy, were creating aliens and animal-man hybrids and all kinds of creatures
right.
for film and TV that I then started getting referrals for that. So that's kind of how I got into that business. I never sought it out. I never thought that was a job option. So I didn't know that I could, seek that. So I was actually still, my dreams and aspirations were, I want to get on a sitcom and I want to sing and dance.
Even after all that.
But now I'm growling and swiping at people.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Right.
Well, you mentioned about not minding all the makeup, and did you expect any of that when you started doing that, or did it just simply not bother you? You thought it was fun. What was your attitude, or how surprised right. were you when you started getting the full body suits and things like that?
Right. Well, my first experience with wearing a big heavy costume was in college. I was the mascot, Charlie
right.
Cardinal,
yeah.
for the Ball State Fighting Cardinals, which is not a really imposing figure, is it? Fighting Cardinals. It's like chirp, chirp, and swat, swat it with the wing. I don't know. So,
it's still a big costume, though.
It was a big costume. I had to wear big wings and floppy feet and a big head with a crest on the back. Yeah, sure. So, and then running around a basketball game for, 2 hours a couple times a week, I understood what hot, heavy, and sweating your ass off. I understood what all that was about.
Right.
And I understood what... that also taught me what creating, emoting some kind of posture that communicates, whether it's, Charlie Cardinal had to mm-hmm. communicate all kinds of things from the neck down, because the face was this glued on, face that,
had one emotion.
Bird. Right. So I learned a lot from that early phase in college. So I knew, all right, well, now I'm getting cast for things where it's going to be under heavy rubber makeups and suits that zip up the back and, big mechanical heads that are put on me with like, mm-hmm. built into the face. And, I don't even know how you translate that, but it's in the face, but you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so when all that goes on, it's like, okay, I knew. And I was, when you're in your early 20s and you're just getting your first gigs and you want to be an actor and they're paying you money to do this and it's going to end up on TV or in a movie theater, of course it's exciting. And if it comes with hot and heavy and uncomfortable and long hours, it's like, that's just a part of the deal, Now, the older I've gotten, the less I enjoy it, of course. But now I can be a little more picky and choosy with, mm-hmm. Taking the roles that excite me, that move me, that are a part of a story that's really got some redeeming quality to it, or the character, even though he's heavily made up and heavily suited, maybe it's got great interaction or maybe even great dialogue and great relationships on film with the other characters. If those things are all in place, I'm still excited to do it.
And it seems like you've been given the opportunity to do both in and out of makeup parts, and you've been able to handle each equally well. I mean, for those of our fans out there that know you from being behind the mask and seeing you, again, being able to portray emotion and really even no without even speaking on some parts, that you're able to scare people through your motions and through and how you move. To say my name is Jerry, where you're kind of leading the whole show there.
Oh, thank you for even knowing about that. That's my favorite indie film I've ever done. And he's my favorite human character I've ever played, is Jerry. And
there are some awesome stars that you played with in that movie that that have gone on to do some of my favorite television shows, in fact.
Well, right, yeah. Exactly. First of all, we had some veterans in there. My boss in the movie was Catherine Hicks from Seventh Heaven.
Oh, yeah.
My best friend in the movie was Don Stark from that 70s show.
Yep.
But the kids in the movie, the younger generation in there, we had Stephen Young from
Walking Dead. Yeah, Glenn.
And My Name is Jerry was his first movie.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So, and he was living in Chicago at the time. We filmed in the Midwest, and we did some local casting, and that's how we found him. And he was such a delight to work with, and hilarious, and would go off the cuff really well.
Mm-hmm.
He came from an improv background. So it was no surprise to me that when he moved out to L.A., he got management right away and started doing commercials and then ended up guest starring on this or that. And then before long, Walking Dead's coming out and he's a series regular. Of course he is.
Yeah, and now everybody knows who his face. And then Allison.
Scaglione. Allison Scaglione was my daughter in My Name is Jerry. And then, of course, after that. Now, before My Name is Jerry, she had done Drake and Josh on the Nickelodeon.
Yep.
For a while.
I remember actually from that, because I have a young daughter, so...
Of course.
I remember watching that.
Right, and then, so after My Name is Jerry, then she does another breakout on the Sci-Fi Channel in...
Warehouse 13.
Warehouse 13. I knew there was a number in there.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking of Area 51, and that's not right.
Similar.
Warehouse 13, exactly. And it's very successful, still going strong. She's great, yeah.
And so... When you started getting these parts, especially some of the bigger parts, you know, people might have started tracking you and getting a beat on you through Hellboy, and then going back and realizing, holy crap, look at all these, we've been watching you for all these years.
And no one knew.
And not even knowing it. Everything from, I mean, again, you know, for me having kids and from Hocus Pocus and seeing
Hocus
you in
Pocus,
that.
Yeah.
Going back and watching that, actually, all I can remember from that—I mean, I've seen it, of course, many times—but I still remember just seeing you and then cutting your lips open.
Right.
You know, you've had some.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's funny. Hocus Pocus came and went out of the theaters really fast when it was in 1993. They released it in the summer at the wrong time of year, so it wasn't really Halloween season yet. So it kind of fizzled. And they were promoting it as a Bette Midler movie as opposed to what it's become, which has been a family-friendly Halloween seasonal movie.
Right.
And with the life on home video and now video on demand and television, ABC Family, ABC, Disney Channel, everyone runs it every year.
Mm-hmm.
It's like The Wizard of Oz now for Halloween.
Exactly.
I had no idea it was going to turn into that kind of phenomenon 20 years later. It's like it's more popular now than it ever was back then. So, That's been a fun turn of events. And when the first Hellboy came out, you're right, the internet was now alive. And that's something, you know, for your young listeners, we didn't have the internet back in the day. And, you know, right, so you could have a full long career and nobody could know who you are. But the minute when Hellboy came out, people could just look at, with one click of a finger, who's this blue fish guy in Hellboy? And then, you know, a whole litany of information comes up about me.
Otherwise, you'd have to go and look it up in Fangoria or fan magazines or stop
back
the...
Back in the day, we did, right?
Yeah. And look at the credits.
Do you have any idea who that guy was?
Yeah.
I know.
Well, how is it now when you've done these things as far as recognizability? You're still... I think people are still discovering you, even though the ones that do know you think that, oh my gosh, how could you not know who he is? So.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you, but... In the right room, I can be a rock star. Like if at Comic Con, for instance, and, you know, I go to comic conventions, and there's comic book conventions and fantasy sci-fi conventions all over the country. And when it's announced that I'm going to be there, I might be recognized by everybody walking down the aisle. Yeah, of course. But at a Starbucks in Omaha, Nebraska, nobody's gonna know who I am.
Nope.
which is just fine. But you know, there even though I've done a lot with my own face now too.
Yeah.
There are so many options for entertainment now that we, like I said, back in my day when we had three networks, if you were on TV, everybody knew it. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're on TV, people may not even be watching. They're on the internet. They're here. They're there. There's just so many entertainment options, and they might be gaming with their friends all over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much distraction now that you have to be everywhere to be really recognized. So.
And it seems like you've been picking some really great, as far as your career goes and the things that you've been in. Again, even knowing and unknowing that these are going to be either iconic films or ones that have some legs, some staying power, everything from
right.
You know, your early stuff, but also things like The Guild, the web series.
Thank you.
That's great. I'm a big fan of The Guild, so.
Oh, me too. It's a great show. Felicia Day was rather genius in coming up with that whole idea.
Sure.
When she was, after her days on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when she was having trouble getting a job, like a lot of us do, when the show ends, it's like, what's our next step? We never know.
Mm-hmm.
And
which you were also on Buffy. People,
right, exactly. I did my guest star on Buffy as the gentleman, the lead gentleman in the Hush episode.
Yeah.
I think when you say picking material, it's a toughie. When you're given a script to read it and know, you know, is this something that's going to be worth everyone's while? Is it going to, does it have potential to be a hit? For me, I don't think in terms of like, is this going to be a hit? Is this going to make me more famous? I think in terms of, is it a story that moves me, that entertains me, that makes me laugh or cry or be scared, or, you know, or is there suspense? Is it a page turner? Does it make me want to know what's going to happen next? If all those elements are there, that's what makes a hit anyway. So, but if it's a good piece of art, let's do that first. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully the good piece of art will be popular enough to become a hit. That's what I hope.
Well, some of the challenges that you've done too, not only in makeup, I wanted to ask you about, again, as a fan situation, reading about your experience with Pan's Labyrinth and saying the dialogue, actually, because there's, you know, when people go back and they look, oh, wow, they realize that, say, Abe Sapien's voice is overdubbed by another actor, but yet in Pan's Labyrinth, is that your voice and you're having to speak? In that language?
Yeah. The whole voice issue needs clarification because that's been like the monkey on my back for all these years. In the first Hellboy movie, I was dubbed over by David Hyde Pierce, yes.
Yes.
In the Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, that is my voice.
That's your voice, right.
Yes. And also as the Angel of Death in that movie, we ran two tracks with my voice that became the Angel of Death's voice. I had to dub over everything. I had to go voice loop the entire thing because those teeth on the Angel of Death were so big, I couldn't get my lips around them. So I was talking like this the whole time. So we ended up, the Angel of Death, I'm very proud of that one, because it was my idea to lay two tracks of my voice down. So we did one voice up here like this, and another voice down here like this. At the same time, they ran them together, and that gave you kind of a little bit of a chilling sound like coming out of Angel of Death. So that was us. Now in Pan's Labyrinth, that was in the Spanish language, which is a language that is not my native tongue. I don't speak it at all. I had to learn the language of the film, and I didn't learn it phonetically. I actually learned it word for word and broke down the sentence structure and knew what I was doing.
Wow.
But what happened was I told Guillermo del Toro going into that I will fail at this movie. You must not hire me. I can't do the Spanish dialogue.
Really?
That's what I told him. His answer to that was, what actor in their right mind would say no to that brilliant piece of art? But I was like, I guess no, I can't pull this off. I'm terrified. So he said, don't worry about it. You can count to 10 for all I care, and we'll dub over later. So I thought... Yeah, right, and that seemed comforting at the time. Like, okay, well, maybe there's a way for me not to ruin the movie. But by the same token, I didn't want to leave him with me counting to 10 with gusto while he tries to dub over that. There's no lip sync to be had, you know.
Right.
So I thought I really need to learn the dialogue so that when they so that and I know it's going to sound horrible, so maybe they can get somebody to dub over it, and they'll at least have the right. I can create the. I still want to create the performance and have control over where he pauses and where he shouts and where he. You know, I want all that to be mine. You know, so I. We did that, and by the end of it, it's like, shoot, why did I ever suggest you dub this over? Because the Spanish crew in Spain was telling me that they didn't even know I was American. You know what I mean? So it was great. Because it was so well rehearsed and well memorized, it came out of me with a flow that was like, well, you see, he's not a foreigner. You know, so it was really very sweet. That's
awesome, you know, walking away from a film and being able to be proud of something like that. You know, not only did you do the thing that you do, you did something else that you didn't think you could do.
I went way outside my comfort box, and it was actually an accomplishment that I never thought I would have the chance to say, I pulled that off. But in the end, he did stick with the voice actor that he got to dub over me because there were nuances that he could go back and direct that voice actor that I could not hear with that language. So in that instance, it's quite all right, and it was not a blow to my ego at all or anything. Just to like, please fix the film. You know what I mean? I want it to do well. I don't want my you know, crappy Spanish to ruin it, you know.
Well, and speaking of voice, you've done a few things not only with Hellboy, but some other things as far as being a voice actor behind the scenes, say for TV, for animation and video games. How was that experience, and how did that differ for you than having to act it out?
Yeah, that's different now. Yeah, right. It's a different animal altogether. You still, I think, as an actor, you still, you know, do your homework and you still find the character's heart and soul and what motivates them. All that has to come out of your voice instead of your body is the only difference. So you kind of just channel that same preparation and that same artwork out of a different venue in your body and your soul. It just comes out of a different portal.
You find yourself when you're doing that, are you still moving as if you would have if you're acting it?
I do a little bit because I can't stop moving anyway. I'm talking with my hands right now. You just can't see it, right?
All right.
So yeah, absolutely. But it is a different animal because you're worried that you need to make your movements heard instead of seen. So it is a different technique. Yeah.
So let's talk about things that you have going on right now. It looks like you've got lots of movies in the works, different things. What would you like to talk about?
If you look at my IMDb page, there's a bunch of red marks on there, but, you know, in production, pre-production. Yeah.
It's always like that for everyone. They're like, what?
Yeah, half of them are lies. I don't know. But, you know, I've read scripts. I've said yes. I've signed letters of intent to a few projects that just never got off the ground, and they're still on there. So I'm not sure, you know, what all's going to happen. Maybe they're not lies. Maybe they're just being postponed. But there's a few things on there that maybe shouldn't be right now. But I can tell you what I'm excited about right now is are three projects that I would love to tell you about. One is The Neighbors on ABC, the TV show. It's a silly sitcom. Now, remember, my childhood dream was to get on a silly sitcom and be a goofy neighbor. Well, here's a show called The Neighbors, and I get to be one of the goofy neighbors in the show. It's on ABC on Wednesday nights right before Modern Family. So that would be the 8:30 time slot, or in the Central, it's 7:30. The Neighbors... the premise is a human family has moved into a vacant townhouse in a gated community in New Jersey, and what they don't know is that the rest of the neighbors, the entire gated community, is full of aliens who are posing as humans. They took over the whole neighborhood when they moved in 10 years ago.
Oh, nice.
Then one alien couple got angry and left and flew back to their planet, and leaving one vacancy. So this human family moves in, and so it's this clash of culture, and, you know, it's aliens learning from humans and vice versa. It's a very funny, funny show. It's written and produced by our head writer, head producer is Dan Fogelman. Dan Fogelman wrote and produced Crazy Stupid Love and The Guilt Trip, most recently with Barbara Streisand and Seth Rogen. He also wrote and produced Cars 1 and 2 and Tangled and Bolt, those great animated films.
Oh, wow.
So
yeah.
He's just a brilliant guy and such a funny... He shows up to work to laugh. It's a very love-driven show, not fear-driven, you know. Which is great to find in the Hollywood land, where your producers and your bosses are not fear-driven, because it's a very fear-driven business. Like, if this doesn't sell, we're all screwed and we're ruined, and so tension and anger comes with that, and egos come with that. But not in this case. This is all a love-paced show. Everyone's just so happy and fortunate to be there, and we all know that. And so I have been blessed on that show to be a recurring guest. I've done 6 episodes in the entire season, and I've got 2 more yet to air. So I'm not sure when this will be heard by your listeners, but 2013, this would be in March, like, you know, March, like, so they're coming up soon. My last 2 episodes are coming soon. I think my last episode on the show is the musical episode. Now,
I was going to ask you. Do you get to sing and or dance in this?
Yeah, no, so here you go. So sitcom and sing, song and dance, all my dreams in one show, it just happened.
I think,
Oh my gosh. And the music for this musical episode, and I think it airs March 13th, 2013. I believe so it's coming up in a couple of weeks. Wow. The music for these big production numbers were written by Alan Menken. Now, Alan Menken, of course, is this huge name. He's the one who brought Disney animation musicals back with The Little Mermaid.
Right.
And then went on from there to do Pocahontas, Hercules, whatever else. Tons of movies. And so we did choreographed by Anne Fletcher. She's actually a film director / choreographer. She also directed 27 Dresses and The Proposal, and she also directed The Guilt Trip. That was her Dan Fogelman connection. So it all, so working with the best people in the business, and The Neighbors has been an absolute dream of an experience for me. And I get to just, all the alien neighbors on the show are, we're all named after, we named ourselves after,
really?
After human, athletic icons, because we think that they're the best specimens to name ourselves after of the human race. Yeah. So we all go by the two lead aliens, the mom and dad figure that are aliens, are Larry Bird and Jackie Joyner Kersee. and I'm like basically in the neighborhood. They have established me as sort of a second in command. And if anything happens to Larry Bird, I get to take over. And my name in the show is Dominique Wilkins, the real Dominique Wilkins was a basketball player in Atlanta, back in the Michael Jordan days.
Oh yeah.
So what a hilarious concept for a show. It's ridiculous fun. So that's number one. Number two, right now, John Dies at the End is a movie that, and this would appeal to your horror fans.
Yep.
It is horror, but it's also hilariously funny. John Dies at the End, written and directed by Don Coscarelli, who gave us the Phantasm movies, along with Bubba Hotep.
Oh, yeah.
And the Beastmaster back in the day with Mark Singer. So he adapted this book called John Dies at the End by David Wong, and it is a delightful romp. There's creepy, crawly things in the movie. There's another dimension to be dealt with. There's kids who are taking some kind of street drug called soy sauce, and it makes them hallucinate, but they're not hallucinating. It actually has opened them up to see the other dimension. And so I play Roger North in the movie, and I'm sort of the gatekeeper between the two dimensions, and I'm the one who invites them and informs them how they're supposed to get to this parallel universe and how they're supposed to save Earth because of it.
Wow.
Earth is in peril. Here's how you're going to save it. So I have two very key scenes, and I just have had such a great time working on this.
It looks like a lot of fun through the trailer, and also you get, I mean, there's some great stars in this too. Paul Giamatti.
Yes.
Clancy Brown, who is hopefully, yes, I'm trying to get on for the film festival that we're doing here in Omaha. He's in another movie. And he's going to be in Omaha, actually, so we're trying to get him on. But
terrific.
Yeah, just it just seems like a lot of fun, so I'm glad that you're in it.
Yeah. So I think that right now, being that we're in late February 2013 right now, so it's been in theaters in select cities. It's moving its way across the country slowly. I think it's going to be playing in theaters throughout select cities throughout March of 2013.
There we go.
So there's that, and then it goes to video. I think it's also playing on video on demand right now.
Yes, I think I have seen it on there. Yep.
Right, and DVD, Blu-ray should be coming in April. So I think we're good with that. And my last thing I want to put pitch and probe is I have been added to the series regular cast of Falling Skies on TNT.
Ooh, why really? Okay.
So if you've seen that show, it's a sci-fi driven show with starring Noah Wiley from ER. He and Will Patton are sort of leading the resistance. Aliens have taken over Earth, and the series in season one starts right after the alien apocalypse has happened, where so now Earth has been taken over by aliens. They're killing off all the humans and collecting the children, and the humans, a few humans have holed up and are fighting back, and that's led by Noah Wiley. So now that we're starting season three, and that's where my character comes in, and I am an alien species that has landed, and you don't know if I'm a friend or a foe, if I may, because they haven't had good luck with aliens at all yet. So when I open my mouth for the first time, I speak perfect English because I've got a translator collar on that I can communicate through. And I have, so throughout season three now, you'll see me become sort of like a Spock character. I've got that kind of wisdom about me, that kind of poetry and prose comes out of me. I'm very talkative character. Every time he opens his mouth, he can't shut up. And it's also a full rubber-faced, you know, glued-on makeup alien. I stand tall and proud, broad-shouldered, with a thin neck, and it's a great design done by Todd Masters and his company. And I get very, very tickled pink with it. And he speaks with such eloquence. So it's a great character that I think will have. I think he might become beloved by the fans. I sure hope so. But that season starts airing on TNT in June of 2013 and will run through August. So it's a 10-episode season that'll be on TNT starting in June.
Oh, awesome! So even through that makeup, do you get to pick? Do you get to work with the character? They usually tell you. So when you start on Falling Skies, that they say here's what the character is, and you had to kind of work with them to develop it, because you seem rather taken by the character yourself.
When it comes to the development stage, I'm usually added to the mix after those drawings and sculptures have already been done. Mm-hmm. Usually the drawings and the sculptures usually inform them, oh, you better get Doug for this, because yeah. If that's how he's shaped and formed. So it was Todd Masters who got a hold of me and personally and said, like, I don't know if you're interested in doing a television series or not, but we have this character that's designed, and I think it's going to be you. And I had a back and forth with him just personally because we know each other from before. And then we got, you know, agents and managers and everybody involved and the network involved. And before long, there was a contract and I was on my way. So... But I did go in for early sittings, and starting a new character like this, a new otherworldly creature on a TV series, Falling Skies is executive produced by Steven Spielberg, so it does have there's a lot of layers of decision makers, and nobody wants to look bad, so that it's like a very like. He better be perfect. So the design went through many phases. And even when I was filming my very first episode up there in Vancouver, up in Canada, we did my first episode with my face not glued on. So I was wearing the bubble head with the face pulled off of it because they hadn't really agreed on a design for the face yet or a color scheme for it yet. So I did my first episode with my face off, thinking, like, what are they going to digitally enhance and put this on later? Once they finally did get the colors and the shapes and the crevices all where they needed to be on the face, they glued it back onto me. We went back in and shot, did some pickup shots to get those scenes from episode one.
You're
so
right. Wow.
We'll see how that goes.
Well,
I think it's going to work out great. They landed on design that really works and works well.
Yeah, definitely have to pick that up. So we've got the Neighbors, Falling Skies, and John Dies at the End for you coming out real soon, actually right now.
Yes.
I do want to thank you again for being on the show. I know we've kind of run out of time here. I do want to mention that the director for the Omaha Film Festival says that he looked all over to try and find it, but the Butterfly Circus was one that he said it was an amazing short that he wanted to say that that he really liked you in a lot. So.
Oh, that's very sweet. Yeah, I love to do short films, especially when they have a message or something very special behind them. And the Butterfly Circus is absolutely the most empowering, touching short film I've ever seen or been in.
And we'll let the listeners here go search that out and watching it because it's worth it.
You can watch that in its entirety on YouTube somewhere. Mm-hmm. If you just do a search for The Butterfly Circus, you will find it.
Excellent.
If any listeners want to keep in touch, the landing spot for me on the internet is thedougjonesexperience.com. That's thedougjonesexperience.com. You can also find me on Facebook. I can't add any more friends, but you can certainly subscribe or follow to my personal page or like my public page, one of each. And I also am on Twitter at Actor Doug Jones on Twitter.
Excellent. We're going to leave those links up on our show page as well, so people can go right there as they're listening, and they can click on that and open those up and get all that information as well.
That's terrific. So. Thank you.
All right. Well, again, thanks a lot so much for speaking with me. Again, I was a big fan, so half of this was true fandom here trying to interview you. But I do appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you in not only the things that are coming up, but what you've got going on in the future.
Great. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Well, take care, Doug. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Necronomicast, a weekly podcast produced by Wayne Brecky, part of the Free Life Media Network. For show notes and other information, go to necronomicast.com.